meeting of the Public Safety Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee.
And we will start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Considine? Representative Dean?
Here.
Representative Hertaus? Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Howe?
Here.
Representative Lomer?
Here.
Representative Lucero? Representative Neuberger?
Right here.
Representative O'Neill? Representative Quam?
Present.
Representative Schoen? Representative Ward? Representative Winkler? Representative Zerwas?
Here.
And Representative Rosenthal?
Yes. Okay. We'll start out with the move of the minutes. Who would like to move the minutes for January 27th of, our committee? Representative Lomer moves the minutes for January 27th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carried. And today we have Board of Peace Officers Standards and Training. For those of you that haven't been acquainted with them, they're called the Post Board. And rather than me blather on, I'll let you introduce it and start out with your name and title, sir. Good to see you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nathan Gove. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Post Board. Seated to my right in the red blazer is Mary Bjornberg, a longtime employee of the Post Board. She is the continuing education coordinator and was the interim executive director from last July until this past November 10th when I took over as the executive director. I've also invited Mr. Dan Boydum, who's seated behind me. He is our budget officer from the Office of Fiscal and Administrative Services. Hopefully the laptop from the Private Detectives Board will do better than the one I was utilizing. So, but I'll be happy to begin, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The Post Board was created by the legislature in 1977. Senator Bill McCutcheon and Representative and then Senator Don Moe were behind the legislation. And Minnesota was the first state to switch from a statewide police academy paramilitary training model to an occupational licensing system with college-based degree programs. Minnesota continues to be a nationwide leader in producing some of the best educated and most professional police officers in the nation. In fact, agencies outside of Minnesota regularly come to Minnesota to try to pluck away our graduates and currently licensed officers to work in their agencies, especially ones from the south where it's much warmer. As part of the enabling legislation in 1977, the mission of the Post Board was created, which is to enhance the profession of law enforcement in Minnesota through the selection, licensing, and regulation of peace officers. This is no small task, given as of this week, there are 444 law enforcement agencies in Minnesota, from one officer to over 800, with over 10,500 actively licensed officers. So why the change? One rationale is the state has obviously a vested interest in the professional and consistent police practices statewide. All citizens deserve the very best in public safety services no matter where they live, from Ada to Zumbrota, Aiken County to Yellow, Medicine County. And so training for the law enforcement profession in Minnesota begins in the college classroom, with a partnership between higher education and the law enforcement industry. This partnership results in students earning a 2 or 4 year degree in law enforcement or criminal justice studies. And Minnesota has 32 professional peace officer education degree program locations throughout the state. There are 29 accredited professional peace officer education programs at 32 locations. Oh, okay.
I mean, Director, you don't have to worry about your, they can catch up later. We've got your slides here.
Okay.
So don't worry about it.
So what were the results? Minnesota has set the standard that all entry-level officers have at least a two-year or a four-year college degree. A study in 2008 by Metro State University of actively licensed officers indicated 48.9% held a bachelor's degree, which was up from just under 30% in 1990. Today, officers who patrol our streets in Minnesota, it's not uncommon that they have advanced degrees. I myself am a product of this system, starting my career back in 1985. For the Elk River Police Department and actually Representative Sirwas's father. And I appreciate that. So the Post Board, as an occupational licensing and regulatory board, performs a unique public service. By providing key service strategies to our stakeholders, we accomplish this through our regulatory component based on statute and rule. However, Post is also a resource. We have numerous stakeholders, and if you look at our stakeholders slide, you can see there's a variety of institutions and associations and individuals that we regularly meet with and interact with to fulfill our role as a parallel role as a resource for the law enforcement profession in Minnesota. Some key services that we provide. As I spoke to, we license and relicense over 10,500 actively licensed officers. There's another almost 2,000 inactive officers that still maintain their license with continuing education credits but don't currently work for a law enforcement agency. We have part-time licensed officers, which as of today has dropped from 177 to 175. This was a legislative change. I believe last year that we put a sunset on, well, not a sunset, we don't renew or reissue licenses. Once an officer either retires or quits, that license goes away. So 175 as of today's date still carry a part-time licensed officer, which limits how much time they can work, only to 1,040 hours per year. So some key service strategies. Post writes and administers licensing exams. Now we average over 1,000 per year, and this would be regular licensing exams as well as interstate reciprocity for officers who have experience from other states who wish to come and work in Minnesota, as well as military reciprocity exams. And over the last biennium, we gave 97 military reciprocity exams. We monitor agency compliance with mandated policies and procedures. We monitor compliance with continuing education requirements of officers. We monitor compliance of standards of conduct, and we manage a training reimbursement fund that in fiscal year 14, 401 agencies in Minnesota put in for reimbursement or partial reimbursement of their training costs, and just under 9,000 officers. So that, I would direct members to look at handout number one that shows some statistics dating back to 1995 on what that per officer share has been. A high in 1989 was $477. But this account is sort of the formulas, the amount of money in the account by the number of agencies and officers that qualify, which you have to be employed at least 8 months for the agency, divided by the amount of money. So obviously in 1989, which my chart doesn't go back sooner than or earlier than 95, there were obviously less officers in Minnesota, a couple thousand less actually. But in fiscal year 14, the reimbursement was just under $322 per officer, which is a percentage of the overall training costs that an agency would have. In Minnesota, as of last week, today, there are 444 law enforcement agencies. And you can see the breakdown. Obviously, most are municipal police departments. We have 87 sheriff's offices.
Director, we've got a question here by Representative Dean and then Lucero after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is regarding the reimbursement account totals. And I'm curious, how much of the training costs are being reimbursed from posts, or on how much of it is actually being paid by the departments themselves, just sort of as a general rule?
Well, it fluctuates by department, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, based on the number of officers. A higher percentage you will see would be an officer, a department of, let's say, three officers, and their total cost, they would get just under $1,000. So that percentage would be higher for that agency, but certainly an agency like Minnesota or Minneapolis with over 800, their reimbursement costs are going to be much lower. As an example, Golden Valley, which is the previous department I worked for 20 years, we would average about 9 to 10% of our overall training costs would be reimbursed to us.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just taking it back one step, the reciprocity test. What are the qualifications or additional requirements, I should say, for both military and law enforcement in other states who want to take the reciprocity test in terms of length of service, et cetera? And then part two of my question would be, how would you describe the primary difference between the regular test and the reciprocity test?
Our director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero. Concerning the reciprocity, you have to have 5 years of law enforcement experience in another state to take the test. The test is, while I have not taken that test, it is similar to the original, what we call the POLE exam, the police officer licensing exam for students that don't have any experience, but it is a little bit different. And a study guide, so to speak, is published on what officers need to read up on, such as state law, criminal procedures, et cetera. We have a very consistent pass rate on that if officers study. So with the previous law enforcement experience, it certainly helps them. Concerning military, it did require 5 years of military police experience, but a recent law change, I believe it was last year, as part of our work with the National Governors Association, reduced it to 4 years of military police experience, which is more in line with what a military person, their commitments would be in four-year increments. Before, it was 5 years. And then I'm sorry, the last question. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Director.
I just wanted to point out on these agency statistics, when you look at our tribal police departments, our non-municipal PDs or special PDs in the state agencies, of this number, one-third are seven officers or less. And only 16 agencies have more than 100 officers. So one of the challenges for POST certainly is legislation and rules that impact law enforcement in Minnesota have to be applied equally from an agency and their resources of one officer up to an agency like Minneapolis and over 800 officers. Since 1990, 135 agencies in Minnesota have consolidated, contracted for service, typically with the sheriff's office, or disbanded. Our current staffing at POST is 10 people. This is down from 15 in 2001. And our staff positions, the executive director, we have a testing and licensing coordinator, takes care of the tests and the relicensing of officers. Our standards coordinators, we have two to cover the entire state. We have a pre-service education coordinator who works with our 29 professional peace officer education program coordinators, and we have a continuing education coordinator who accredits training providers and also does random checks on currently licensed officers to ensure they have their 48 hours of continuing education every 3 years. We also have an office services supervisor and three office and administrative support personnel that help give our in-house test to reciprocal and military that we run once a week at the post board, as well as walk-in and phone traffic, which we receive a lot of phone traffic as a resource by agencies asking questions. Concerning the post board, there actually is a post board made up of 15 members, of which the only ex officio position is the BCA superintendent or their designee. But as you can see the breakdown, there's 15 members appointed by the governor to 4-year staggered terms. And a very specific category of the board makeup is at the bottom, that one person on the board must be an elected official from a community outside of the metro with a population of less than 5,000, and that's currently Mr. Steve Stotko, who is the mayor of Winsted, Minnesota. So how is POST funded? Through a...
Director, could
Mr.
you
Chair.
First tell us how many people are on the complaint committee and what their rank or title is, not their names, but...
There would be three people on the complaint committee. They must all be present for a quorum, two of which must be peace officers.
Oh, in rank, does it have to be a chief or a sheriff or district?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
And we have alternate members, of which some are the public members as well.
Okay, thank you, Director. Go ahead.
So our post funding is from a special revenue account that the original surcharge was $25. That account has risen to $77. POST is funded from the original $25. I'm told that the amount, the actual $52 above our original $25, that fund generates about $14 million for other types of legislative directed programs. Our surcharge breakdown is of the original $25, 1% or 25 cents goes to the DNR for training, 39% or $9.75 goes to POST, and 60%, $15, goes to the general fund. Obviously, the legislature sets the POST budget. Of the amount that the POST board receives, 73 to 75% is returned to local units of government in the training reimbursement fund. And the remaining 25% is for our general operating budget. And you can see the, and I think I asked the committee to refer to handout one. That's our service strategies. But handout two is actually the chart I was referring to regarding the breakdown of the per officer training share. So our budget for fiscal year 15 at just over $4 million, of that, nearly $3.9 million is from the original special revenue that prior to that, in I believe 1998, it was based on moving violations, a surcharge on that, and that has since changed. In 2007, the legislative session, we created a non-DWI reinstatement fee of $20 that is estimated to generate about $250,000. You see that line under the special revenue. In fact, current estimates put it at $220,000, and this has dropped from $417,000 just 4 years ago, and there are a number of factors, maybe one of which people are showing up in court and paying their fines, because those are the two elements that would kick in this particular surcharge, is if their licenses are suspended for failure to appear or unpaid fines. The other factor that would also impact that amount would be if people just aren't going back to get their driver's licenses reinstated. which in my experience as an officer seemed to be the case, but that is anecdotal. Now, the $100,000 is a one-time appropriation for a specific training on sexually exploited and trafficked youth training, which is put on by the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and POST is involved with the disbursement of the funds. And the $50,000 is a one-time appropriation. It's actually an e-grant to the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute for specific training on crisis de-escalation strategies for veterans. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any additional questions, and I appreciate the opportunity as the new executive director to appear and answer questions.
Okay, Director, the loss in FTEs over the last few years, has it been due to budget or efficiencies or just on your own, or has it just been because of the lack of funds coming back that you've had to reduce?
It's been a combination. We've had one in-house IT person leave back in 2014, and that those services are absorbed into Minute, more of a statewide initiative for technology, and certainly there will be a budget cost for us to pay for that service. We won't have anyone in-house. The other reductions have been due to budget constraints.
And Director, the lack of being able to take care of the credits per officers like you used to, that came as a decrease in your budget also, did it not? I mean, you used to be able to keep track of the 48 hours per officer.
That's correct.
That caused some angst, I know, when you had to do it. But the point is, that I was trying to make to the committee here, is that you've suffered budget restraints and lost some people and the ability to do certain services, and part of it's probably been because of the reduction in the funding and your share of what you should get. There's a statutory direction how much you're supposed to get, but it's not set in stone. The legislature sometimes reduces that by not giving you enough in your budget. So the other question was, and I've got probably have a couple other people here, but the sanctions on the complaint committee. What is your full list of options when you have a complaint on an officer, all the way from a letter of reprimand or a suspension for 1 day or 30 days, or do you have the authority to suspend it completely so that the person has – what's the full range of sanctions if a complaint committee goes to the full board and it gets approved? And
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that is true. There is a wide range of sanctions. For a felony conviction – that is an automatic revocation, and Minnesota revokes approximately 3 to 5 licenses per year out of over 10,000 actively licensed officers. We have the ability to suspend their license, enter into a stipulated agreement and consent order with the licensee concerning additional training steps. If it involves a chief law enforcement officer who's not meeting state mandates for policies, ongoing training, that could result in a suspension of that chief law enforcement officer's license. We're advised by the Attorney General's office as part of that process, and obviously we have to be mindful of sort of past sanctions depending on to maintain some reasonable consistency. So anywhere from additional training to suspension to an outright revocation upon a felony conviction.
Director, also you can suspend for less than a felony if it's a certain offenses. What are they, like theft and?
Yes, there's a variety of all gross misdemeanor convictions come before the board, and a number of misdemeanors concerning vulnerable adult, domestic assault, a variety of incidents that, but not all misdemeanors. And, those are in rule and have been established for quite some time. But, yes, they can come before the board for individual officers.
Director, any idea of how many complaints you receive a year that come to your board on officers or CLEOs, chief law?
Yes, in the last biennium, 13 and 14, we handled 297 approximately complaints that are, we monitor them. They are passed on to the law enforcement agencies. The Post Board was not created as a statewide internal affairs unit. We're occupational licensing, but we direct those complaints out to the law enforcement agencies and ensure that they're following their policy and making a decision on the allegation.
Director, any idea how we compare to other states in that category? Have you ever researched that?
I know that other states significantly revoke many more licenses based on serious crime convictions.
Okay, and hopefully that's because the of our training is better and we get into less trouble.
I would agree with that.
We have a couple of questions here. Representative Hertaus, followed by Representative Zerwas.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Director, on the agency's statistics, there's a category called non-municipal PDs, police departments, but I guess I was thinking about or curious whether or not those licensees who hold federal badges, whether or not they're compliant or meet the standards that we've set as a state.
The director.
Representative Hertaus and Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of that. I don't believe Minnesota has any authority over that on a federal agency. The specialty agencies, of course, are Minnesota agencies such as Metro Transit, the three university campuses that have officers like Duluth and the Twin Cities and Morris. And they meet our requirements. But I'm not aware of concerning the federal agencies.
Representative Hertaus?
Well, thank you for that reply. And I guess I asked the question because I was just curious. In our history as a nation, it appears that we have been oftentimes, as states, silent with regard to the actions of the federal government and its enumerated powers. So recognizing the sovereignty of the states, I guess I would ask ourselves to look at that question whether or not we ought to require that minimum standards are employed with regard to dealing with the public, regardless of where they're from.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, I can certainly look into that, and if you'd like, I would be happy to respond to you on what where we're at on that.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Gove. I guess the one question I would have, you talked about some misdemeanors coming before the Post Board. I'm wondering if someone was convicted of violating the Minnesota Data Practices Act, i.e. the DVS situation, if a conviction there is an automatic review by the Post Board.
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas, it is not. It is not listed as that their license would come before the board. But I can tell you from experience as an officer and administrator that certainly would have administrative impact on that officer and their employing agency, because if their ability to access that system is revoked for a period of time by the state, DVS, that would be a real question of that officer's employability for that agency, as that is part of their job. So, but it does not come before the complaint committee.
Representative Johnson and then Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Director, I have more of a comment to make here. Other than probably Chair Cornish, I'm actually at a post license. And I want to thank you for the work that the Post Board does. Minnesota has probably the highest trained and the best law enforcement officers in the country. As the director had mentioned, we have people, departments from all over the country coming to Minnesota to recruit our best candidates. And unfortunately, they get too many of them. So I want to commend the job you do with the Post Board and with working with the colleges to get some very well-trained and very good officers out on the streets in Minnesota. And as far as what Mr. Hertaus had said, asked about on the federal issue, I could not remember if they had to be licensed or not. As you said, mentioned, they do not. But I will tell you this, working with many of those agencies, not only on a task force, but also working the streets, anytime they would come to a jurisdiction to investigate something, whether it was dealt with the Secret Service, the FBI, all of them that I've worked with over my career, they always came to the department first, checked in, and had one of the local officers assist them in doing their work. So they are checking in and doing what they're supposed to do as well. And also, for those who don't know, the qualifications for these positions at the federal level for law enforcement, if you ever looked into it, most of them have attorney's degrees. So they are very well trained.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that is true. My experience dealing with agents from such as the Secret Service and the FBI, they have advanced college degrees and extensive training, and my experience is they worked very well with law enforcement. And the FBI can't make a probable cause arrest in Minnesota. They have to actually get a warrant if they're going to take somebody into custody or work with the local authorities.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. You had mentioned earlier in the testimony that you're not a statewide internal affairs component. And my question would be, if you were, what would that look like? And how would that sort of change your mission and the structure of the post board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, you know, in terms of our 10 employees and our budget, 75% of which goes back to local units of government, we would become a significantly larger agency and a budget that I could not even begin to predict, because it would be difficult to cherry pick which complaints for agencies that the Post Board would investigate. And if you look at just the wide variety of the agencies in Minnesota in terms of their size and location within the state, I would make the argument that two compliance standards coordinators that I currently have to go statewide and try to visit these agencies to ensure that the mandated policies and other legislative directives are being followed in terms of training, we can only get there once every 5 to 7 years just by the staff that we have. So taking on an investigative role and the expertise that would be required of that, we certainly do when it comes to the occupational licensing concerning convictions, and not having mandated policies and training in place. Our complaint committee handles that approximately 15 per year. I think the last biennium it was just under 30 things that came before the complaint. So it would be very significant in our staffing and our overall budget.
Okay, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. Can you tell me, when you're talking about compliance and doing the reviews, what is the most common problem you find, or I don't want to say problem, but being short of compliance, if you will, in departments? And are smaller departments having problems with a specific area of training because of funding? Is it record keeping? Is it evidence retention? What is the most common problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, I've been at the post since November 10th. Some of this is just based on my sort of experience as a law enforcement officer and talking with members, but as well as our standards coordinators. My sense is a lot has to do with record keeping, actually ensuring and documenting with verification, because we want documentation, but we want verification that officers are receiving, for instance, emergency vehicle operations, driving a training every 5 years. And that is an expense. There are limited providers in the state, but officers need to do that if they're going to be operating emergency vehicle red lights and siren and engaging in pursuits. Ensuring that use of force training is done on a yearly basis, not only classroom, but hands-on training in the very tools that an officer would carry on their belt. And that includes firearms, ensuring that they have mandated policies. And that's been consistent for us, but at times some of them need to be tweaked a little bit to ensure that they meet the model policy. So it tends to be record keeping and ensuring that the mandated training for officers is being conducted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I understand what you're out looking for. What I'm looking to find out, and if you need to go back and look through records or and maybe give us some insight, because I've never asked this question. If it's emergency driving is the most common thing that's a problem for agencies because of, you know, Black Duck PD has three officers or whatever it may be, where is the nearest facility and how difficult is it for them to be able to get there? And if the funding is that much of an issue, then what do we do here to help, or how do we help mitigate that? Because if it's a common theme that it's one thing, then we maybe have to have discussions about how do we help in those scenarios. So I'm looking for the pieces, not what you do, but the exact specific areas that are the problems, and most commonly. And maybe if it's not, it's all over the board. That's fine too.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schoen, I could certainly try to pull that data. I do know that training is a challenge for agencies, and especially given that one-third of them are smaller than seven officers. When you take an officer and send them to 8 hours of training or four or whatever it might be, because they need 48 hours every 3 years, that's a scheduling issue. It's a public safety issue, as they have to backfill, and many of those communities don't have 24-hour law enforcement coverage anyway through that agency. So I'd be happy to get more specifics on that. And in terms of your second part of your question about, well, what can be done? Well, certainly the fee for the reinstatement, which goes directly, that $250,000 has significantly dropped and continues to drop for a number of factors. More officers, more training that they're putting in for, and so that helps out local units of government help offset those costs.
Okay. If there's no more questions, thank you very much for your presentation, and we'll probably have you back soon once we get our fiscal analyst back and up and running, and the budget books, or at least a printed copy if we don't get the full book, and have you back for the budget hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Okay, the Board of Judicial Standards overview is next, and rather than butcher your name, I'll have you start out with how you properly pronounce it here. And even though I met you, I forgot to ask you how to pronounce
it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Vasily, good morning. And I do have our annual report.
You better take the seat there, and we can hear you that way. They'll hand it out for you.
Okay.
Pages. You can just have a seat there, and and if you could give your name and title again for the record into the microphone there.
Good morning. Tom Vasily. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Board on Judicial Standards.
And this was, maybe you planned on it anyway, but why don't you give us, to start out, I know when I met you it was quite impressive, your background, what you've done before you got this job.
Well, I've been around the block. I've been practicing law for 45 years. I started out in legal services representing poor people. After about 13 years, I went to the Minnesota Lawyers Board, which is the oversight board for lawyers, for about 6 years. Then I spent 13 years with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office defending the state in civil litigation. And I've had my present job for just 1 year.
Okay, sir, go ahead with your presentation.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you. My board, the Board on Judicial Standards, is the board that handles complaints about judges' behavior. And I'll say right at the beginning that our jurisdiction is over judges' behavior, not their decisions. Complaints about decisions are for the Court of Appeals. We handle complaints about behavior. And when you get my... I don't know if it's handed out yet or not, the annual report. Mm-hmm. It's coming. Okay, well, on page 10, I believe, we have some examples of our case, of the public cases that we brought. One, and they often tend to find their way into the newspapers. One of them involved Judge George Perez. That's the bottom of page 10. He was a tax court judge who was consistently late in getting his decisions out. The legislature has passed a statute saying that judges must make their decisions within 90 days after the matter is submitted to them. He was consistently beyond the 90-day period, and far worse, was covering up the fact. So we brought a case against him, and unlike regular district court judges, tax court judges must be confirmed by the legislature. And once the matter had been heard, the recommendation to the Supreme Court was that it find that Judge Perez had been not honest about when he was getting the cases out, the next day, practically, the governor recommended that the Senate not confirm him. The Senate acted within a day or so of that recommendation and did not confirm Judge Perez, and he was out of a job the following day. It eventually got its way to the Minnesota Supreme Court, but by that point he was already out of a job, so the Supreme Court couldn't remove him twice, and they censured him. On page 11, toward the bottom, you'll see examples of some of the private admonitions that we've issued. There's a range of discipline, ranging from private admonitions to reprimand to suspension to revocation. So the least serious cases are on the bottom of page 11. And the first bullet point, it's just an example. It was a complaint that came in a year ago. A tenant, it was eviction court. So the tenant comes in, and the judge asks him, did you pay the rent increase? And the tenant said, I paid the base rent. The landlord did not have the right to raise my rent. And at that point, the judge said, oh, the landlord has the right to raise the rent. You don't get a trial. We're not going to take any testimony. Judgment for landlord. So that judge got an admonition. If the judge had heard all the evidence and ruled against the tenant, we would not have touched it. We would not have jurisdiction. But to come in and say one party does not have a right to their day in court, and one party, the other party, can get judgment without even having to prove his case, the judge got an admonition. I'll mention that my board was created in 1971, and before that, the only remedy available for a judge who was engaged in improper behavior was to impeach the judge. And the legislature has done that maybe once or twice in the entire history of Minnesota. It's a very cumbersome process, and the only options are either dismiss the impeachment or remove the judge. My board, as I indicated, has this range of options. If you go to page 1 of the annual report, you'll see that we have 10 members, 4 judges, 4 public members, and 2 lawyers. And down at the bottom, you'll see the staff, and you'll see that we have a very tiny staff. It's just me and one assistant, a permanent staff. Page 2 and page 3 discuss some... I'm sorry, sir.
We have a couple questions
here. Sure.
Representative Hertog?
No, I don't.
Okay. You can continue.
I'll continue, Mr. Chair. Okay. We've had a lot more emphasis on education. We issue advisory opinions to judges, both informally when they call me, and we also issue formal opinions on subjects that come up repeatedly. We've got a website that is available to the public and to judges showing what we do. It has advisory opinions on it, and it also has some of the disciplines that have been imposed. So if you want to actually read about some of the cases that are mentioned in the annual report, you just can go to the website, and we've got the opinions there very accessible. So there's a big emphasis on the part of the current board with transparency, education, and treating judges fairly. We get about 100 complaints a year. That's page 7. So I will indicate that some the numbers do not necessarily include the complaints that are dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. The majority of complaints that we get are people who are dissatisfied with the judge's decision, and we don't have jurisdiction over that. Some of those complaints are dismissed immediately with an appropriate referral, and other in other cases, a file is opened, and then the case is dismissed. On page 8, you can see the list of the most common allegations, and you'll see at the top, we have bias, discrimination, or partiality. The majority of complaints throw that in. And we'll say, what is your evidence? And the evidence in almost all cases is, well, he ruled against me. So the mere fact that you've lost the case is proof that the judge must have been biased against you. So those complaints are, I think, just another way of say of complaining about the judge's decision using different words. So in the event that there really is evidence of bias or partiality, we'll look at that. If there's an allegation that the judge's demeanor suggested bias, if it looks like there might be something to it, we'll get a hold not only of the transcript, we'll get an audio of the hearing, because the transcript will not reflect tone such as sarcasm or anger. And in the event that a judge has a pattern of appearing to have his mind made up or to be impatient with people, those judges have been disciplined, and a couple of those cases are posted on our website. The next page, 9, as you can see, the vast majority of complaints are brought against Minnesota State District Court judges. We also have jurisdiction over appellate judges, referees, and so on, but they're a small minority of the complaints. And on page 10, back where we started, for the calendar year 2013, there were 7 dispositions. So out of the 113 approximately files that were open that year, discipline was issued in 7 cases. Now, I can continue or I can stop now for questions.
Anybody have any? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, on record retention compliance, it says here that it doesn't have to be released until the judge is no longer in service. Is that correct? And if so, why? Because one would think you'd want to know problems that have arisen with the judge in the past.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, if the complaint was resolved publicly, that file is retained until the judge's death. If the complaint was resolved with a private admonition, it's retained indefinitely until the judge's death. If the complaint was one that the board found it dismissed for whatever reason, the rules provide that that complaint in general is dismissed after 3 years.
Mr. Representative Rosenthal.
I guess it's a little hard for me to understand the internal admonitions, why they would be held until a judge's death. Because if I were in the legal justice system and there are problems with judges, I'd want to know.
You'd want the admonition to be public?
I'd want to know that. What and maybe not public, but there should be some way for us to understand if there's a problem judge that's being reprimanded, not in public.
Oh, absolutely.
And how does that work?
Well, that's an excellent question, Mr. Representative, Mr. Chair, and the decision on how to size up a case correctly is, I think, one of our most important responsibilities. If a judge has done, I'll give you an example. A judge is supposed to make, as I indicated, a decision within 90 days. In one case, the decision was not made until 100 some days after it was submitted. This judge had no prior history. The judge apologized profusely. and has never had any problems since then, that judge received a private admonition. In the event that that judge ever applied to go to the Court of Appeals or federal magistrate or some other position, they typically require the judge to sign an authorization so that that private admonition would then be disclosed. Now, if a member of the public came in and said, I want to see the private admonition, they'd say we would say no. And so one of the most difficult decisions for the board is when should something be public? When should the discipline be public? On the one hand, you don't want to be unnecessarily embarrassing the judge for just a minor instance of neglect. On the other hand, the public does have a right to know. I will say that there is not currently a pattern of private dispositions involving any Minnesota judge. So it's not as if we're accumulating them and keeping it. Very few judges have gotten private admonitions, and those that do, it's almost always once. I can't think of a judge off the top of my head. I can't. There's one or two judges that have gotten more than one admonition, but at least the one I'm thinking of has retired. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd like some definition of who might have access to private admonitions. And here, Mr. Chair, is my thought. If I have a judge with a predisposition towards something that's been found to be not appropriate, I would like the lawyers defending those clients and whoever is assigning cases amongst judges to have access so that we don't further open up citizens to the possibility. Frankly, there should be some protection, whether it's private or public, that we can protect citizens from going, or those types of cases, from being seen or heard by that judge. So if we can be enlightened as to how private are these things when it comes to assigning cases or to members of the bar.
Mr. Bashley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, the private admonitions are accessible only to the judge, to our board, and to the governor, for example, if he's considering appointing the person to the Court of Appeals. They're not accessible to the bar, for example, or to the public. But to put this in context, on page 10, you'll see in 2013, only two private admonitions were issued. And on page 11 and 12, it doesn't indicate which ones are I believe the first two on page 11, on the bottom of page 11, are private admonitions. And so you can judge for yourself whether that conduct is so serious that it should be publicly disclosed.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frankly, just because there aren't a lot doesn't make something excusable or to be overlooked. And to some individual, because there's a process that was brought about, it was important, it possibly severe, and I would hate to trivialize these matters by saying there are so few. And again, I feel that we ought to allow some protections to at least allow members of the bar who are representing clients to have access to be able to request a different venue, or the, depending on the court, how you disperse cases to avoid dispersing cases when someone has a confirmed issue. And I'm just disappointed we don't have that already.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, I should first clarify that there is one other person that's told about the private admonition. That's the complaining party. the complaining party is notified in writing, and in some instances that complaining party does not keep it quiet, and especially in rural areas and small towns, the buzz gets out to the courthouse pretty quick. You make an excellent point, and certainly not only for the judges but for the lawyers, this has been debated for many years, and some systems have attempted to do away with private admonitions. Some of those jurisdictions found that if you had a case in which the judge's conduct was clearly non-serious, isolated, just not something that would justify public disclosure, in those instances, the board in those states was not imposing discipline at all. So if they had a choice between either dismissing it or going public, sometimes those cases would be dismissed, and there would not be a record kept.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
There is, as I mentioned a couple times, a middle ground, because members of the bar have certain standards. And so, you know, I guess I would find it a good motion to allow members of the bar access upon request. And frankly, if that was recorded somewhere, to ensure that they behaved appropriately. But we, you know, that way, at least we have made some motion in between public and, you know, buried in the backyard.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenthal, followed by Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, is it public information if these private admonitions, thank you, exist, even though the content remains private, or it's not public?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, are you asking?
Rosenthal, pardon me.
Representative Rosenthal. The fact that the admonition has been issued is disclosed to the complainant, but not to the public generally. However, one thing we began doing last year is, in the interest of greater transparency, both to the judges and to the public, we have begun posting examples of the admonitions on our website. We removed the name of the complainant and the name of the judge, and you can go there now. And so if someone feels that someone can go to the website, look at that admonition, and make up to her own mind whether we're acting appropriately. And I would invite any committee member that's interested, look at that admonition. And reasonable minds can disagree on how serious something is or is not. And you can read it, and then you can form your opinion about whether the board acted correctly in deciding that was a private admonition rather than a public reprimand.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you. And I just want to make it clear that the public has no way to find out about these private admonitions, even though the content still remains private. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment that I think we're a little bit off on the wrong track here and getting too worried about the private admonitions. The important thing is, number one, this is not the avenue for appeal if you feel like the decision is wrong or if the judge made a mistake or was somehow coming to the wrong conclusion. That's what the Court of Appeals is for. Judges also have to file economic interest disclosures just like we do, so that their economic interests in a particular case are disclosed to the public. And certainly parties in litigation are well within their rights to make any kind of motion to get a different judge if they feel like there's any kind of conflict of interest or other sorts of bias that's somehow going to prejudice their case. That would be normal, and in a decision to not do that would be appealable also. So these are more about the ways that judges conduct themselves on the bench that have to do with their personal demeanor and conduct. They're not necessarily things that rise to the level of public disclosure, because I think you're right. I think the independence of the judiciary is something that anybody who works on these issues is going to be most concerned about. And if people who lose litigation make a complaint that a judge was being kind of irritating in how they talk to people, and every time they thought maybe he stepped over the line or she stepped over the line, they're going to have a public reprimand, I just don't think they would do very much of it, because it's not the kind of conduct that really rises to a level of prejudice, which would be dealt with in the ordinary course of litigation. So I think, you know, I think we're kind of on safe ground here.
Okay. Questions, anybody? Go ahead, sir. Were you done, or you still got some left?
Well, I could close by commenting that one of our concerns right now is the amount of money that we're spending on litigation. Our basic budget for the office is very tiny because there are just two of us permanent employees right now. What really costs money is when the judge contests the case and we have to hire an outside firm to litigate the case. And one of the ways in which we are trying to save money is by doing more of the investigation in-house. So when I do it, my staff does it, it's far cheaper than when a law firm does it. And we're hoping that we do have a request for a slight bump in our budget to pay for a halftime attorney and investigator to continue this effort. And so I'm hoping that what we'll see in coming years is that actually our budget is going down because we're not having to ask the legislature for special appropriations on a case-by-case basis to pay for outside counsel.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Your expenses go up when a judge contests the ruling. How often does that happen? You don't have that many rulings anyway, but how often does it happen that a judge contests the ruling?
Sir?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, the board doesn't have any power on its own to impose discipline against the will of the judge. The judge has the right to request a hearing. And I would say we get about one case a year on the average, but those cases are ungodly expensive. The last one, the one I mentioned, Judge Perez, because of that case and another case, this board asked for a $300,000 special appropriation to pay for it. Fortunately, we only had to spend about half that amount. When you have a pattern, when somebody is not just committing misconduct in one case but a variety of cases and is covering it up, penetrating that pattern takes a lot of investigative time, a lot of litigation time. So that it, we basically have enough a budget for one case, one litigated case a year. If another case comes in that we have to litigate, that basically blows the budget.
Okay, there's no more questions. Thank you very much
for
your presentation.
Mr.
Appreciate
Chair,
you being
members
here.
Of the committee, thank you very much.
And now we have the Private Detective Board overview. Executive Director Greg Cook and Budget Officer Dan Boydum. And whoever would like to begin, go ahead and state your name and title for the record into the microphone and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Greg Cook. I'm the executive director. If you can bear with me 1 second here, we have to get a PowerPoint going. As stated, my name is Greg Cook. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Private Detectives and Protective Agents. It is my responsibility to regulate and provide oversight to the private investigative and protective agent industry here in the state of Minnesota. I understand that I have some limited time, so I've provided you with a detailed handout that has some data and some briefs and a summary of our activities for you to review. I have a brief PowerPoint in which I'm going to highlight some of the data from that handout. I'm going to ask that you shift gears here as some of the numbers you're going to be seeing are smaller than what you've been used to seeing in the past couple of weeks. Our agency is appropriated $120,000 annually to provide regulation and oversight to the private detective and protective agent industry here in Minnesota. All revenues received go to the general fund. The chart that you see on the screen shows the historical spending from 2002 to 2013. The next chart shows the amount of revenue generated compared to the appropriations from 2000 to 2014. If you can see it, the revenue is in light blue and the appropriation is in red. In the past couple of years, our revenues have increased dramatically. In fiscal year 2012, the revenue generated by this agency was approximately $131,000. In fiscal year 2014, it increased to $180,000. This is a 37% increase. As far as the peaks and valleys you are seeing, for whatever reason, we've had fewer applicants, which means less renewals or uneven years. As you can see in 2014, that has changed. As you can see, starting in 2012, the low points seem to be evening out and the high points are reaching record levels. We are only halfway through the year and we have some excessive renewals in the next 6 months. You also may not be used to seeing such a simple pie chart. 97% of all expenses go to payroll. This includes salary and benefits. This past year, I was fortunate enough to have an excellent assistant, Kelly Guralnik. She was an intern who became a student worker, and then I hired her as an administrative assistant. As of this coming Friday, her position will be eliminated as we have depleted the funds for that position. 3% of our spending is for everything else. This includes everything from office supplies to postage and also Office of Administrative Hearings. So you can better understand some of the data that I'm going to show you, I wanted to briefly cover what our license holders do. I myself am a licensed private investigator, and whenever I tell somebody that, 9 out of 10 times they respond by, oh, you follow cheating spouses. I put on the screen a number of various specialties that private investigators are involved in. These services are requested by and they benefit to the public, businesses, and government entities. I myself am a certified fraud examiner, and I specialized in employee theft, fraud, embezzlement, and mortgage fraud. As you can see, some of the other types of services, elder abuse, insurance fraud, locating missing children, these are types of services you don't hear about as often. There is a need for these services, as not all law enforcement agencies have the resources or specialization to accommodate the needs of those who are requesting it. On the security side, these services also augment law enforcement. You probably have heard the labels Rent-A-Cop or Barney Fife. What people do not always realize is that private security provides essential public safety. In general, there is a 3-to-1 ratio of security to police officers. In downtown Minneapolis, the ratio is 13-to-1. You can see on the screen some of the services and facilities that are protected by private security. Though I do not have an exact number, I can tell you that an overwhelming majority of our licensed private investigators and protective agents are retired law enforcement and military. I wanted to show you this chart so you can get an idea of where our revenues come from. These are the original license fees and the renewal fees paid by our license holders. They range from $800 to $1,900. It is worth noting that these are the third, if not the highest, licensing fees in the country for these types of services. In some aspects, I think of license holders as our clients and customers. The perception of these clients and customers is that they are expecting service for the money they are spending. The types of services we provide will be evident in the next few slides. This chart displays some statistics for what we have accomplished the past couple of years. Note that besides fiscal year 2013 and 14, I added a column that covers the first part of fiscal year 2015, the past 6 months. I purposely did this so that you can see our activity is increasing. In the past 6 months, our agency has processed more applications, officer changes, training, instructor certification, and penalties than in the whole previous year. Another number I could talk about for hours is unlicensed activity. This is a serious public safety and consumer protection concern. Individuals and businesses, entities that are providing security services, sometimes arms, and investigative services without verification that they are qualified. This includes ensuring that they have a clean criminal background, they have the required 6,000 hours of experience, they are properly trained, they understand the law, they are financially responsible for liabilities, they are not taking advantage of clients, and more often than not, they are not paying taxes. Some of the cases we've had on unlicensed activity we've worked on include an unlicensed security company providing services to schools, including large high schools, a bounty hunter who is also doing security and investigative work with a substantial criminal record, an unstable individual who had a picture of him holding an AK-47 advertising security services on his website, an individual posing as a DPS investigator in order to get information. We received numerous calls of elderly, mentally challenged people being scammed. Given the opportunity in the future, I'd love to give you a presentation on this subject alone. Here are some statistics regarding those who do go through the proper procedures to get a license. As you can see, since 2012, we have gone from 282 to 342 license holders. That's a 21% increase. Please note that every additional license holder increases our workload exponentially. The number is broken down further into 226 private investigators and 116 protective agents. A very important number to know is that these license holders employ 7,500 to 8,000 employees. Our agency has to verify the background check, training, and ID issuance for each of these 8,000 employees. When I state there are 342 license holders, it is misleading, as the real number we regulate is 8,000. Another responsibility is ensuring the license holders are receiving qualified training to meet their CEU requirements. Per statute, license holders must obtain 12 pre-assignment hours and 6 hours every year after that. Armed guards must receive an additional 6 specific to weapons and first aid and CPR. This includes annual certification on the firing range for those who carry a firearm. We currently have 85 training providers and 930 approved courses. These are our core functions, otherwise known as key services. I'm not going to go through the whole list, as you have it in your handout with descriptions, but I do want to highlight a couple of items. Applications. This is the one thing I find most legislators are concerned about, is the length of time it takes to process an application. Last year, the governor instructed all agencies to streamline their procedures, and we've done that. I can tell you that we went from an average of 14 months to process an application down to 3, and you need to understand that the statute guidelines regarding this application process is extensive. I have listed some of what we do in the handout. It is imperative that we ensure only qualified individuals to obtain a license. Renewals. This is actually one of the most important. If a license holder does not have a dated license, they can lose contracts, they can lose insurance, and they can lose business and employees. Equally important is complaints and investigations. Most of our license holders are of integrity and abide by the rules, and we try our best to keep the license holders above bar. Some of these investigations we do are extensive in the use of resources. As we are not online, we do not have online services, and deal with a lot of paperwork, our administrative task load is enormous. We do have a number of projects that we are currently on hold due to staffing considerations. In preparing for this presentation, I came across the legislator's request to my predecessor to provide a comparison of our agency to others in the state. This piqued my curiosity. I used the data off of one of the state's websites and was able to put together some information. I would like to note that some of this data needs to be verified, but graphically this is accurate. What I found was we are the second smallest agency in the state. What I also found was we're the only agency without online capabilities. I'm also in the process of gathering data from my counterparts across the country, and all indicators are we are the smallest agency with the type of regulations we do in the country. That is all I have for you with my presentation. In closing, I would ask that if you get a chance to review our meeting minutes, which are on our website, to get more of an idea of what we do. At this point, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Director, could you get specific about the difference between a protective agent, the security, first of all, each one of the different licenses that you operate under there, and the difference in what they can do, armed versus unarmed, and like that.
On the protective agent side, Mr. Chair?
How many different brands of licenses do you have? Do you have a security guard and a protective agent, both?
No, sir. We don't have security guard licenses. Some states do. There's protective agent, and it's broken down further between the private detectives and the protective agents in that you can get an individual license, a partnership license, and a corporate license. So on the protective agent side, protective agents, there's not a separate license to be armed. If they are going to be armed, they do it by our statutes and receive that extra training.
Okay.
I do not have any statistics as to how many are armed and how many are not.
They're not licensed under the permit to carry then, and then allowed to carry by an employer. They're armed under a different statute then.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And so there's a difference between a protective agent and the security guard?
Well, they're both considered, a protective agent is really the license holder. The security guard would be an employee of that protective agent.
Okay, I got you now. That's why I was a little confused in the numbers. First, we were talking 8,000, and then one said 282 up to 300 and some.
That's all that, Mr. Chair, there is some confusion there, is that those are the license holders. Those are the people that hold the license. So they can employ as many security guards, for example, as they want. We have some security guard companies that employ 1,500 to 2,000 people.
Okay, out of all of those people, how many of them are armed, do you think?
Mr. Chair, I do not have that statistic. I could attempt to try and find that for you, but I'm not sure. I would have to go through all 342 files in order to determine that number. I would have to look at what's called the affidavit of training, which provides the armed training for the security officers.
How do the security guards get along with the police departments? Is there any competition there, feeling they're taking their jobs, or... Because I know some police officers work part-time in security and off-duty and are allowed to by their employer. How do they get along in the competition thing?
Mr. Chair, I've heard no complaints. As a matter of fact, our protective agents get along very well with law enforcement. They work hand-in-hand.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like there's probably enough work for everybody out there.
There is enough work for everybody out there. Absolutely. In Minnesota, as I stated, there's 342 license holders. In some states, they have up to 5,000. So there's plenty of room in Minnesota for growth.
Now, when you were presenting some budget items here today, too, of course, we're going to have you back when the budget booked, but what does it look like you for the future? Are you running short this year, or I didn't see any deficiency requests. I mean, you got enough funding to make it to the end of the fiscal year?
Mr. Chair, I'm not here asking for any more money. We will carry forth with our budget up till July 1st, that $120,000. That is correct. I will be having no staff during that time. My staff is done this coming Friday, as a matter of fact. But we will make do.
Representative Dean, followed by Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. My question sort of relates to the question of Chair Cornish, in that we have the licensed agents, and then we have the employees that work for them. And my question is, you had mentioned something about continuing education for the licensed agents. Is there any continuing education requirements or, continuing training requirements for those employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there is. So that 6 hours a year, that 12 hours pre-assignment, that 6 hours extra armed, we have to verify for each one of those employees. That is a requirement per statute.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. I'm just a little curious about the lack of a website, and presuming that there would be great usefulness to the public as well as your license holders to have that information available through a website. Is that something you're planning, wanting, needing to do, and how would that be helpful to you?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you very much for the question. Just to clarify, we do have a website. What I'm talking about as far as online capabilities is the processing of renewals, applications, training, certification. Currently, everything we do is through hard copy paperwork. And it would be very beneficial if this was all done online. It would be much quicker and efficient for the license holders as well, and it would be allow us to produce some reports such as you have requested today, some data and statistics. Currently, we do not have a budget that allows us to get that online capability. We did look into it. First looking into it, I talked to Minute, MNIT, and their figure was $250,000 to initially set it up, and then an unknown huge figure to maintain it going forward. I then talked to e-licensing, and frankly, I could not get a very straight answer from them. The best answer I could get was it would be $50,000 to initially set it up, and about $16,000 a year to maintain it, and then there were some unknowns to that. I did request some information from them for this presentation. They have not gotten back to me.
Representative Ward.
Just a little follow-up. It looks like there are some other agencies that might be able to give you some comparable information, and just in terms of comparing those prices. That's a huge spread, and it does sound like it would increase efficiency and help you in many ways. So I'm assuming that you're going to come back with, when we do the fiscal aspect, to include that in your proposal for the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you very much. Yes, we are still currently researching this situation. My understanding is e-licensing has gone through somewhat of a change. They're trying new software. They're beta testing some people. They're having some issues with it. I am not going to limit my research to just e-licensing. There are some other aspects that we are looking at. I have a structure of what we need to do in my head, and I'm ready to lay that out for somebody that can provide us that. But again, right now our funds are limited as far as being able to afford that.
Thank you. Director, you mentioned you had to let somebody go early because of funding?
That is correct, sir.
Okay. How often does that happen in your budgetary cycle?
This is the second time that has happened.
Okay. All right. And normally this person would have stayed on for as long as they wanted to or whatever?
That is correct. This individual in particular, the first time the individual did want to stay on, we ran into a deficit situation. We had to eliminate the position. That was back in 2012. This situation, again, this person was brought on as an intern, did an excellent job. I then brought her on as a student worker. As you're aware, there's some limited cost to payroll to student workers, so we were able to afford that. And then I was able to bring her on as a part-time administrative assistant. And we kept that going as long as we could. But in looking at the numbers, and she was made aware of this 2 months ago prior to it, and I'm happy to say that she was actually able to find a job right as this position was ending. But our funds were depleted for payroll to have any staff in the agency.
Then one more question for me, and then Representative Neuberger has one. But one more time, your total FTEs and your total budget, all funds, what would that be?
You know, at this, I think I'd like to ask Mr. Boydham to assist.
Mr. Chair, I'm Dan Boydham from the Department of Public Safety. We provide the fiscal services for the Private Detective Board. The budget request, the base budget is $120,000 a year, and there's only one FTE. So,
all right.
There's sometimes surpluses that arise, which allows for a hiring of a very part-time staff. But when we're talking about a half part-time staff, we're not talking about a half-time. We're talking like maybe quarter-time or that nature. And that's just due to the resources that are appropriate to this agency.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Cook. A couple of really quick questions here. It's my understanding that a majority or a large portion of investigative work, it's really not boots on the ground, it's more hands on the keyboard. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. In this day and age, okay. Much of your information can be gained off the computer. Private investigators with that license are able to subscribe to certain data services that allow them to find information. Back in the old days, it was looking through the phone book and gumshoeing, so to speak. But these days, majority of the information can be found on the computer.
Mr. Chair, Director Cook, then, if private investigation is really taking a kind of a cyber, approach, hands on the keyboard, do you have, are you noticing then a correlating response and complaints of people saying, look, this individual's been investigating me, I believe they've been doing so inappropriately through a cyber avenues. Is that something you hear, or is that just something that's not coming up at all?
Director? Mr. Chair, Representative, surprisingly, I'm not hearing that a lot. I have heard it a couple times, people concerned about how people have been pulling data up on them. concern about how somebody ran their plate, something like that. But no, I have not, that has not come up often.
That brings me to, Representative Newberg, sorry.
Just one follow-up question then. Director Cook, do you, in your opinion, do you think that this is potentially an uncovered area, that it's happening, but we don't know about it because nobody's looking? Is it, because we hear about on the international scale all the time that there's international cyber hacking, there's all kinds of things that are taking place. So on a micro scale, you know, with individual investigators and private investigators, is this potentially something that's just happening that nobody is really paying attention to? Do you think that this could be an uncovered area?
Director. Mr. Chair, Representative, if you're talking about cybercrime, that's a whole different issue. That's a huge, huge one. I thought you were specifically talking about somebody complaining about a private investigator finding information on them that they shouldn't. Obviously, cybersecurity is probably the biggest and fastest growing market we have right now in private investigations. So,
Representative Neuberger?
So then there's potential overlap between cybercrime and inappropriate investigations?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely.
So,
Representative Neuberger?
So potentially this is an uncovered area?
Mr. Chair, Representative, potentially.
Thank you.
One question here, and then we'll probably close and get out early, maybe. After your comments, but you mentioned a bounty hunter. Explain what a bounty hunter exists in Minnesota and how they are licensed and what they can do as far as actually apprehending somebody. What's it like in Minnesota other than a dog getting into trouble?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, thank you for bringing that up. First of all, we do not regulate bounty hunters. In fact, nobody regulates bounty hunters. The way it works is the bail bondsmen are regulated by the Department of Commerce. They can hire and pay bounty hunters to go find fugitives for them. My knowledge on bounty hunting is limited, but from what I understand, bounty hunters, once somebody doesn't show up for court, flies under bail, they've lost their civil rights, and a bounty hunter can enter their home without search warrants. And I was actually approached by the industry of bounty hunters that wanted me to regulate their industry for them. And I spoke with the Senator Bruce Anderson, I believe, a couple weeks ago regarding that. I guess he was approached by some of his constituents. The bounty hunter specific I was talking about, which is up north, he was doing private investigations and protective agent work without a license, and that's how I came involved in that.
I might just found a second job when I retire.
Any more questions? If not, we'll probably break early for lunch. And any closing comments you might have wanted to make but hadn't yet?
No closing comments. I do appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and I hope I've given you some information. And if anybody has any questions going forward, please don't hesitate to contact you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And the meeting adjourned.